Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. This program is generously sponsored by Visa. I'm Catherine Barron. I'm a journalism fellow at UC Berkeley's Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity. Now, before I tell you who our guest is, although it's not quite a secret, I'm going to bury the lead for a moment and begin the introduction with a few facts. In the spring of 1989, 71% of new college graduates said they believed that, quote, being very well off financially was extremely important. About 43% felt that way about developing a meaningful philosophy of life. The most sought-after jobs at that time were in banking, management consulting, and engineering. And 93% of the class of 1989 said financial security was a major goal in life. Those statistics are from a June 1989 article in Fortune magazine, which culled together research from several universities and organizations such as College Track, whose founder, Stuart Himmelfarb, told the magazine, quote, these people have focused on themselves. At that same time, Wendy Kopp was a newly released Princeton graduate. While her classmates were vying for those jobs on Wall Street, Wendy was moving into a $500 a month brownstone apartment on West 78th Street in New York with a $26,000 grant from Mobile Corporation, donated office space, and a determination to start a national teacher corps for the country's most disadvantaged children. With that leap of faith, Teach for America was born. In its first year, TFA received 2,500 applicants, from which it selected and placed 500 teachers. TFA now has more than 6,200 teachers in the country's neediest schools, working with about 400,000 students. This year, approximately 35,000 young men and women applied for 4,000 slots in TFA, which is undoubtedly why President Obama cited TFA last month as an example of the rise of national service among American youth when he signed into law the Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act. Now, in between that time period, Wendy became the youngest person, she was 23, and the first woman to receive Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson Award. Former President George W. Bush awarded her with a Presidential Citizens Medal, and last year, Time magazine named her one of the world's most influential people. It's been 20 years since Wendy Kopp graduated from Princeton with an idea that led her advisor to call her deranged. And given the enormous obstacles of the first 10 years, which she recounts in her book, One Day, All Children, she might embrace or at least acknowledge that description. So please welcome Wendy Kopp to the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, thank you so much for such a warm and wonderful introduction. I have to get a hold of that article that you just quoted about. I often start these talks saying that, you know, my generation was known as the me generation. And that article said it all. You know, supposedly all we wanted to do was go, you know, work on Wall Street. And the inspiration for Teach for America was really that as a college senior, I felt like that label was just misplaced. Because the people I knew who were all applying in droves to the two-year corporate training programs weren't doing that because they were dying to work on Wall Street or to make a lot of money even. They were just applying to those firms because they could not figure out what else to do. And they all said, we all said, I was applying to the same firms. I guess we'll do that for 2 years and learn a lot and then go do something else. And then, of course, they went to business school and back into those firms. But it was that and my own. I had just descended into a funk as a graduating senior and was searching for something else. And I started getting this sense that I wasn't alone, that there were actually just thousands of other talented, driven people who were searching for the same thing, you know, a chance to assume a significant responsibility that would make a real difference in the world. And I'd been really focused on this issue of educational inequity, had organized a conference on it, and in the middle of that conference just thought, you know what, this is it. Why aren't we being recruited as aggressively to teach in our country's highest poverty communities as we were being recruited at the time to work on Wall Street? So that was the inspiration, and you know, I think if people had predicted then that 20 years later 15% of Princeton's senior class would be competing to teach in our urban and rural public schools, people wouldn't have believed it. But that's where we are today, and at Teach for America, we just believe this is an extraordinary opportunity. You heard that we had 35,000 applications this year, you know, up 40% from last year. 11% of Ivy League seniors applied to Teach for America. At 130 colleges and universities, between 5 and 15% of the senior class applied. We make a huge effort to recruit people who share the racial and socioeconomic background of the kids we work with. And I think it's just stunning to realize that 20% of the African-American Ivy League seniors applied to Teach for America this year, 18% of Latino-Hispanic Ivy League seniors. So I thought I would just share with you all a bit about essentially what we've learned over the last now 20 years in this, which will illustrate why we believe this is such an extraordinary opportunity, and also why we feel both a greater sense of urgency and a greater sense of optimism than we ever have around this this effort that we're engaging in. I thought I would. I mean, really, everything that fuels what we do, and you know, it comes down to what we have learned from those among our core members who attain incredible levels of success with their kids. So this is not to say that everyone. I mean, This is an extreme challenge. Probably many of you know, I think many of you, I should start by saying there's so many people in this room who have helped make Teach for America what it is today. And I know there are core members and alumni and board members of Teach for America and probably many others who have one connection or another. And you know that this is exceedingly challenging. You know, I tell people that, you know, I think in our 10th year, there were maybe 5% of our teachers who were having what we would have considered, you know, life-altering impacts in their kids' lives. And we started spending a lot of time with the 5% and trying to understand what was going on in those classrooms and then trying to feed those lessons back into our admissions model and our training and support models so that we could grow the percentage of our folks who were having that level of impact. And it's really what I've learned from the kind of growing percentage of folks out there that has really fuels everything we do. And so I thought I would just share one example and the lessons we take from examples like this. So I think about a guy named Taylor Delhagen who just finished his 2-year commitment this past year. He taught in Brooklyn, New York. He was assigned to teach global studies, I think it's called, to 10th graders. The thing is that, so he was given 58 10th graders. And this is actually a 2-year class that culminates in a Regents exam in New York City. And the Regents exam is pretty challenging and it's high stakes. You have to pass the Regents exam in order to graduate from high school. Taylor was told he had 1 year to teach this 2-year class. So he starts getting to know his kids and he realizes that not only does he have 1 year to teach the 2-year class, but he is teaching kids who are just unimaginably far behind. His kids did not know the names of the continents, 10th graders in New York City. Many of his kids were reading at the fifth grade level or below. But the good news for his kids is that Taylor is absolutely nuts. And so he said to himself that it was going to take a lot of hard work on the part of himself and his kids, but they were going to throw themselves in and prove to the whole school that, every one of them could pass this global studies test at the end of 1 year. He started going about getting his kids invested in that idea, in this idea that they should work harder than they'd ever worked before in order to reach that goal. He spent a lot of time getting to know the kids, establishing relationships with them and with their parents. These are 10th graders, but he would bike to school every day so that he could bike by the homes of his kids, make sure that some of them who weren't always going to showing up at school on time were actually up and at them and coming to school. He logged, you know, hundreds of hours of phone calls to the kids' families and to the kids themselves. They had a cell phone, you know, 24 hours. The day I visited his classroom, I actually walked in unannounced. He did not know I was coming, but he was standing on a desk, dressed up. I wish I remember the historical figure, but, you know, he was doing whatever it took to get the kids working with him, just deeply invested in this goal. You know, if you get to know Taylor, and I talked to the person we call a program director who was, you know, supporting him, and she said she'd just never seen anyone spend so much time outside of the class planning so that he could maximize every second he had with the kids. And yet even everything that he put into maximizing all the time he had with his kids, he realized wasn't enough. And so he figured out how to spend more time with them before school, after school. He started hosting Saturday class. He made the kids pancakes, took the pancakes to school in a box on his bike. Anyway, you fast forward to the end of the year, and his kids, he had 56 kids, 53 of his kids passed this Regents exam. This is more kids than had passed. I mean, you compare what they did after 1 year with the New York City averages, let alone with what usually went on in the school in Brooklyn. It's just completely different level. And the next year, kids took on the three kids who hadn't passed and coached them so that at the end of that year, they actually could pass this exam, which is just an incredible display of how much the kids were invested in this idea that all of them, you know, would pass this exam at the end of the year. So I step back from examples like Taylor's, and there are certainly, you know, we could share many of them from right around here in the Bay Area and really from any community in the country. And I guess I take three big lessons from that example. The first and absolutely most salient of our work is that this is a solvable problem. You know, what we see in Taylor's example, first of all, is the extent of educational inequity in our country. It's overwhelming when you realize the magnitude of it. And of course, we see it in his example. In, you know, one of the richest cities in the world, we've got 10th graders, many of whom are reading at the fifth grade level or below, who don't know the names of the continents. I mean, this is outrageous. But I think far more stunning than the fact that we can see the extent of the disparities in this example is that we can see hardcore evidence that, you know what? We don't need to tolerate those disparities. It's not that the kids can't do the work. You know, it's not that their parents don't care. I mean, if you ask Taylor, you know, what's at the root of the problem, he'd say, I don't know. I guess the kids just weren't given the opportunities they deserved before this, because he saw them excel on an absolute scale. And it's really seeing that at every grade level in communities across the country every day that does more than anything else to fuel our sense of just responsibility to say, you know what, if we can solve this problem, solve the problem that, you know, still today in our country that aspires so admirably to be a place of equal opportunity, where you're born does so much to determine your educational prospects, but we know it doesn't have to be that way. And if it doesn't, then we have a responsibility to solve that problem. So that's the first lesson and what really fuels our sense of urgency. The second has to do with the essence of teaching. And, you know, when you think about what it was that Taylor did to attain the results that he attained with his kids, he was basically operating like the most effective leaders in any context, right? Like, so he went into a situation that a lot of people would have just thrown up their hand. I mean, this was a seemingly hopeless situation. And yet he stepped back and set the big vision. At the end of the year, we're all going to pass this exam. And then went about doing what any great leader does, which is get people working with you, you know, establish relationships with his kids, dressed up like historical figures, whatever it was going to take. He had the kids tracking their own progress, all sorts of things to get them invested in working with him towards that vision. Then he was completely purposeful. You know, when I sat there in his classroom, the sense of urgency in the room, I mean, this is not a teacher going through the motions of a lesson plan, but someone who's thinking constantly, okay, here's where my kids are. How am I going to get them where they need to be by the end of this class period? And then just relentless, whatever it took. If it took Saturday school, if it took biking by the kids' classroom. So I think realizing that leadership is at the core of successful teaching in the context in which we work is one of the things that sends us to these college campuses so aggressively to say, you know what, we need every person who has that kind of leadership ability to channel their energy in this direction, even if it's only for 2 years, because 2 years from someone with that kind of ability can be truly life-changing for kids. So that's the second lesson of our work. And the third, you know, is that as important as that is, I mean, if you're one of the kids like Taylor was teaching, your only hope is to meet enough teachers who are willing to go so far above and beyond traditional expectations to meet your extra needs. I mean, his kids were coming, you know, obviously way behind, huge extra needs just because of all the challenges of poverty and such. And, you know, they're stuck in a system that no way has the capacity and the resources to meet their extra needs and put them on a level playing field. So for them, their only hope is to meet the Taylors of the world. And yet, as important as it is for the kids growing up today, when we look at and get to know the Taylors of the world, we think, you know what, this can't be the answer. You know, ultimately, we're not going to solve this problem through hundreds of thousands of teachers being superheroes. I mean, first of all, Taylor is a very rare person. There are only so many people like that in the world. And secondly, you know, even he would say, can he do that? He can do it for 2 years. But ultimately, I was talking actually today with a core member who was saying, you know, the reason that he ultimately is deciding to leave the classroom is that he's realizing this isn't going to do it. Like, he's going to see his kids go off into a system that doesn't meet their needs. And ultimately, I guess getting to know the Taylors of the world ultimately is what has led us to also say, you know what? We need to think about how to affect the systemic changes. How do we take some of the pressures off of school so that, in fact, we're not having 10th grade teachers meeting kids who are reading on a 5th grade level? How do we build the capacity of schools and school systems so that talented, committed teachers, but not absolute superheroes, can actually meet the extra needs that kids who face extra challenges bring into their classrooms? And when we ask ourselves, you know, what is it going to take to actually affect those systemic changes, we've come to think, you know what, our best and probably only hope is to get to the point where enough of our future leaders, people working at every level of our education system, at every level of policy, across every professional sector, know what you know after you've taught successfully in a low-income community, which is that, you know what, we can solve the problem, and who have a very grounded understanding of how to solve it. Once you've succeeded at this, you realize, first of all, that there is no one thing. So there is no silver bullet, you know, but you realize at the core what it's going to take to get us where we're all aspiring to be. So that, too, leads us back to college campuses. And our recruitment folks out there on campuses feel such a sense of urgency to recruit those folks who they believe are one day going to be in positions of influence and say, just 2 years. You know, we just need 2 years because we know that the decisions they make long term are going to be very different because of those initial 2 years. So those are the things leading us to try to get bigger and better. Those are the things that fuel our sense of urgency. And I said earlier that, you know, not only do we feel a greater sense of urgency than we ever have, but we feel a greater sense of optimism than we ever have. And I just want to say a little bit about why that is, because it's very possible to be in this work and feel very depressed. I've been at it just for two decades, and you know, we know that billions of philanthropic dollars have been poured into education reform in the last two decades, and there are countless education reform initiatives. And yet, if you look at the aggregate numbers around the achievement gap, they really have not moved, and that's depressing. And yet, from where we sit, so much has changed. You know, I do you all remember the movie Stand and Deliver? I mean, I think that came out. I have to look up the date. I'm pretty sure it was as I was graduating from college. And, you know, it took a teacher in South Central Los Angeles who had coached a class of kids to pass the AP calculus exam. And it made a movie of him. And I thought about that a couple months ago, a movie. You know, I thought, we all thought that this guy was an absolute unreplicable hero. And I just, it's so stunning to me now because I know of hundreds of teachers who are having that kind of impact, who are first and second year teachers just in our own network. You know, I think back to 15 years ago, I don't think we could have found a school in an urban or rural area that was taking a whole school full of kids and putting them on a trajectory to graduate from college at the same rate as kids in high income communities. And yet today, you know, there are thought to be 200 some schools. Almost every community I go to, whether it's, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma last week, to, you know, wherever it may be, has a school, often a charter school. I'm now starting to see a lot of those practices being brought into some traditional schools. So the conversation has changed. You know, it's gone from a world where the Coleman Report, remember the report that in 1966 said that, you know, the greatest influence on a kid's, you know, educational outcomes is poverty. That was carrying the day. And I think to where we are now, where people know, you know, it is possible. We know it's possible. So the question is, can we do it at scale? And even to that question, in the last 4 or 5 years, I think in various communities where we've had unexpected windows of opportunity that have ushered in these governance reforms. So in New Orleans, where there was a hurricane and, you know, people basically blew open the system, in Washington, D.C., where a very courageous mayor assumed responsibility for the system, you go to those communities and you see evidence of the possibility of serious system change. And I just think, you know, Teach for America has, alongside many others, had something to do with this kind of evolution, certainly in growing the number of truly exceptional teachers in low-income communities, in helping to fuel the development of this kind of new generation of very high-performing schools. And you go to New Orleans, and you go to Washington, D.C., and on the ground you see, yes, radical governance reforms, but, you know, what's happening to take advantage of those reforms? It's really a bunch of folks, many of them Teach for America alums, who, because of their experience successfully teaching, are leading in a very different way. So I guess what gives me optimism is thinking about the fact that, you know, this year alone, we will channel more talent and energy against this problem than we did in the entire decade of the 90s Teach for America itself. And that's what gives me optimism that, you know, by 5 or 10 years from now, we will have true critical mass in communities across the country, and that those folks will truly move the needle. So this is what leads us to believe. I mean, at our 10th year, I remember a woman who was standing next to me at our big 10th year alumni summit, and she was looking at the vision statement of Teach for America, which was written on the wall. Our vision statement is that one day all children in this nation will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. And she said, you know what happened to us? We realized we can actually get there. And that's exactly what did happen to us. And to the extent that we felt that then, you know, multiply that by a factor of 10. I mean, we know we can get there. It's simply a question of how many of, you know, our country's most talented, committed future leaders will step up and say, okay, we're going to lead us there. So thanks. And I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Just a quick reminder, particularly for those listening to this on the radio, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with Teach for America founder Wendy Kopp. I'm Catherine Barron. And thank you for those remarks. I'm going to start with a real softball question, and this is came about totally coincidentally. I was in Washington, D.C. last weekend for a conference, was on the metro, and spotted four young women who were TFA alumni. And I knew this because they had T-shirts on that said... So don't tell my kids that I'm not clairvoyant, but they're here. So I said, oh, my gosh, I have to go ask them. What would they ask Wendy Kopp if they could have an audience with her? So the first one...
They're the toughest questioners, so this is not good.
Actually, the first one was kind of very, very easy, which was, does she ever sleep?
Yes, it's important to sleep. That's what we tell our core members. This is hard work, I will admit. I mean, I don't think I've worked any harder ever than I'm working right now. But the thing that keeps me going is that I'm surrounded by... literally thousands of people who would say the same thing, not only on our staff, but in our core and in our alumni force. And I think I would speak for all of them in saying this is exhausting work, but it's just hard to imagine work that is could possibly any be any more fulfilling.
I do remember in your book that in the early years you said you decided to sleep every other day. How'd that work out?
That did not work out well. At the time, it seemed like the only answer, but, I'm too old for that now.
So the other question was, given that you have a record number of applicants, do you have plans to expand the number of teachers?
We are working incredibly hard to expand. I think, sort of per some of the things I was saying earlier, in this world of ours, in education reform, talent and leadership is by far the most precious resource. I mean, if you look at where we are today versus where we were 20 years ago, the reason we are making progress is in every case because of talent and leadership. There's no way around that, right? Like, we need to radically grow the force of folks who have what it takes and are willing to throw themselves into this degree to actually make this happen. And so for the first time ever, I have a sheet that shows, we have 1,000 people on the wait list to get into Teach for America. This is the first year that we've ever turned people away who, met the admissions bar to get in, and it's painful. So we are actually doing everything we can to basically secure the funding to bring those folks in. We have two more weeks. We're in the midst of a huge campaign to try to find the funding to maximize the size of the core this year.
Well, you should be used to that. You talked about how every 2 weeks you had to raise $250,000 to meet payroll.
Thank heaven I'm not sweating payrolls at this point.
I can't imagine what that would have been like. I wanted you to actually do like sort of a role play for us and get on the phone and tell us how did you beg for money every 2 weeks, because I think we all want to know how to get $250,000 every other week. So
I'm still doing the same thing, but luckily it's now for much more inspiring things, not to meet payroll, but to bring in the future leaders of our country and to enable them to channel their energy in this direction. So.
Now, you mentioned that this is a solvable problem, and you also said, however, that several decades into education reform and billions of dollars later, we still have a pretty sizable achievement gap in this country. So I wonder, how do we, you talk about a critical mass, but where is sort of the tipping point between a critical mass of people such as Teach for America teachers and kind of an outright revolution that, as the governor of California once said, blow up the boxes and start over again?
I mean, I think we're going to need many different things to ultimately kind of, get where we're all trying to go. But one thing I'll just say is, just imagine removing all policy barriers tomorrow. The question would then be, are we going to be ready? And what every community that has removed all the policy barriers has discovered is you then are left with the fact that we don't have a talent pipeline. I mean, it's that simple. When Mayor Fenty in Washington, D.C. assumed responsibility for the school system, he asked his policy right hand, who is a Teach for America alum, Abigail Smith, to launch the school superintendent search. This search went on for months. This is a story that is not told. But, you know, every superintendent search in the country, you've got four names on a list. They're the same four names. This mayor was not going to go for the traditional option. And she, I happen to know her well, because she had left our staff to take the job working for him. And she would call every week and say, any ideas? Because I'm still at a blank slate, and I've got to find someone. She one day comes up with the idea, maybe he'd go for Michelle Rhee. You never know. She's 37 years old, but she is a rare talent, this Teach for America alum, who, just to explain how much of a rare talent, took a class of kids from the 13th percentile against the national norm to the 90th percentile against the national norm. She taught the same kids for 2 years in Baltimore City schools. And so she has come in to this chancellor's position. She's surrounded by a force of kindred spirits. Her deputy chancellor, the head of teacher quality, the head of school transformation, the majority, you know, of her senior team, 10% and growing of the school principals, the leaders of the high-performing charters, the KIPP network there. There's now a group called Friends of Reform, hundreds of folks who lobby the city council on behalf of her reforms run by Teach for America alums. And I just think, you know, they are moving the needle in Washington, D.C. It's stunning what they've done. In addition to, you know, in their first year, moving student proficiency levels 8 to 12 percentage points at every grade level and every subject, four times, you know, actually, no, as much progress was made in 1 year as the four previous years combined in the D.C. public schools. But at the same time, they've been affecting just seismic shifts. You know, they shut down 23 schools. They replaced a third of the principals in the first year. They gained the ability to hire and fire the central staff, and they put out there a new teacher's contract, which is, of course, a subject now of national attention, but whereby you could opt out of tenure and opt into a revolutionary compensation package, whereby you could make $130,000 in your fifth year of teaching, some of which is a performance bonus for student achievement results. This is radical stuff, but we need to ask ourselves, why do we have it? And people will say, well, you'd never have it without the mayor. That is true. But we have to ask ourselves, would we ever have it without Michelle and her team and the people she's brought in? And where did those people come from? So I guess I just think ultimately, you know, we cannot solve this problem. You go to any of the very high-performing schools and ask them, what is it? And they'll say, well, you know, it's ultimately leadership. It's the people they recruit into classrooms. It's the culture they build. But at the end of the day, it all comes down, as any success in any industry or sector does, to talent and people.
Of course, Michelle Rhee is now the honeymoon's over. She's starting to get a little bit pushback on her changes. Why do you think that is?
Depends who you talk to. I mean, I've never seen someone with a longer honeymoon, actually. Which pushback are you talking about?
Well, she's been trying to soften a little bit the way that she deals with teachers in the district, because there was some anger over some of the firings and the way they were done.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to get into all of the details of this situation, but I think, I mean, what Michelle represents, if you do a Google search on Michelle Rhee, I don't know how much you've seen her, and just watch the interviews, it's like watching a very different school superintendent. I mean, this is a person whose every other word is, you know, relentless pursuit and sense of possibility. I mean, this is a person who is so deeply convinced. No one will ever shake her from the conviction that we have low educational outcomes in low-income communities because we as the adults have not given kids the opportunities they deserve. And she is just on a mission. And you know, that's really the headline with Michelle Rhee. And she also just gets, you know, that there is no one thing. I mean, I don't know how many people, when I go to D.C. at the beginning of her tenure in the first 6 months, would say, we're still waiting to understand the plan. Like, they're looking for the three-point plan, you know? And I'm thinking, well, you know, Michelle probably isn't going to issue the three-point plan because what she thinks is that this is about talent and people assuming accountability for results, period. You know, they're saying, well, where's the curriculum plan? And I'm thinking, yeah, she probably is not thinking that's the key lever either. Not that she doesn't have a bunch of people thinking about what's the right curriculum, but it's just not going to be put out there as this is the thing. So I think to me, and I look at what others are doing, you know, if you go to a KIPP school, you hear much of the same stuff, right? You know, there are no shortcuts. You know, it's about, I mean, there are KIPP folks in the room who would be brilliant at you know, how they attain results. But I just think it's all the same stuff. Like over and over and over, we're seeing, whether it's in classrooms, schools, or school systems, that it's about having people who deeply believe in the kids, who know what potential the kids have to excel academically, and who are just going to, you know, go about doing everything necessary to meet their extra needs and ensure that they, in fact, do excel academically.
What's preventing other districts from giving a superintendent similar kinds of control and authority? I mean, typically, and it's not just for district leadership and school leadership, but teachers say it's really not the pay, the low pay, that is getting me to think about leaving this profession, but it's the way I'm treated. It's that the administration is either not really supportive or is that there's kind of a reform du jour. So you finally implement something and you're just getting it going and then they come down with something else. And that's what teachers seem to resent, that they are not treated as professionals. And yet we constantly say we want them to be professionals. I think the same thing goes for superintendents who are working kind of in the same situation but with the legislatures or things like that.
You know, there are many barriers and impediments to progress in this education world of ours. And I guess I want to make sure it doesn't become the excuse, because what I've seen all over the country in so many different communities is that if you dive in, you can make incredible progress. So I think about Houston, Texas, you know, and there they've got a school board, which, you know, is the traditional governance setup, but it hasn't stopped a whole bunch of people from saying, you know what, let's see what we can do to move the needle. And I just think back to 1991 when we placed our first corps of teachers in Houston, and we were warmly embraced by the business community. And I remember the first reception where, you know, people were basically saying, this is great. And they were sort of, you could see, they were thinking, this is apple pie. It's like their kids going into schools and teaching. And they said, it's great, but you will never change HISD. Never. And I just think about where we are in Houston today. If you get the civic leadership together, you won't hear them saying that. I mean, you really won't. They'll say, you know, what they have seen is that it is absolutely possible. I mean, to actually solve this problem. And the reason they say that is because there are a bunch of, you know, from Mike Feinberg to Chris Barbic folks who are, you know, Teach for America alums who are out there, you know, with a plan to serve 15% of the HISD students in these extremely high-performing schools. You know, as an example, one of them is, you know, on the list of top 100 high schools in America and is the only high school in the city of Houston to be on that list. It serves kids who are almost all free and reduced lunch from a community where 7% of the kids typically graduate from college. 90% of the kids who go to this high school graduate from college. These guys are literally turning educational inequity on its head, and it's completely changed the conversation in Houston. And that is going to ultimately lead, in our view, to the kind of uprising that will ultimately tip the system. But I just think there are different paths in different communities, but we can't wait for the governance changes, because if we do, then we won't be ready with the people power to actually take advantage of them when they happen.
Here's a question from somebody who is an alum. When I was a core member in 1994, the message was that TFA existed to make changes so that one day TFA would not be needed. Today, the message is grow to scale. How do you explain the change?
Well, I think the magnitude of the problem necessitates a very significant response. And you know, our goal is still at some level the same. I mean, we want to reach this vision and get to the point where, in fact, all kids in our country do have the chance to attain an excellent education. It's just that we are very, very far from realizing that. There are 13 million kids right now who live below the poverty line in our country. By the time they are in fourth grade, they're three grade levels behind on average fourth graders in high-income communities. Half of them do not graduate from high school. The half who do are at an eighth grade skill level. This is in our country. And this is still the same stats that I was saying 5 years ago and 10 years ago. 10% of our kids in low-income communities graduate from college. And so I guess what I would say is, I mean, I'm not sure what we were thinking 20 years ago, but I believe now that we're approaching a scale that enables us to have a chance to truly, I mean, this is going to be a fundamental force. The fact that 4,000 of not just anyone, but our future leaders, 4,000 of them, their first experience out of college is going to be teaching in our lowest income communities, and many of them are going to be incredibly successful with their kids. And as a result, they're not going to be able to leave this, and they're going to spend the rest of their lives fighting this problem. And ultimately, that is, in fact, it's going to move the needle, and maybe we can then, in fact, you know, eliminate Teach for America. Although then we'll have to sustain the just world that we've created. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I'll have retired by then, so it won't be about my own self-preservation.
That will be a rough day when that comes, huh? Someone wants to know, is there a concern that a percentage of Teach for America teachers do not stay in teaching? But I know that that is true, and actually, though, there's a big concern that many non-TFA teachers leave within the first 5 years. I think about half of them leave, but what many of them do actually, if not stay in teaching, have been staying in education.
They do. You know, actually, we have 14,000 alumni right now. I mean, because we've scaled up only recently, that force is going to start growing hugely in the coming few years. But out of the 14,000 folks, 65% are working full-time in education. Some of them are teaching about half of that percentage, and then the rest are in school leadership positions, in school district positions, in education reform roles, or they're in schools of education. I think, though, you know, we believe we need long-term sustained leadership from within our schools and systems if we're ever going to solve this problem. There's definitely no other path. At the same time, we're not going to solve this problem from within schools alone, and all you have to do is teach for 2 years to realize that. Ultimately, you know, we need different policies. We know how policy is influenced, and it's not all influenced by people who are in classrooms. I mean, we need our business leaders and our journalists and people, really civic-minded leaders, to have the perspective that comes from having done this. And I just think this is tough. There's something very counterintuitive about our particular theory of change here, but we just believe this is a crisis. It is a crisis, and sometimes crises just mean you got to think out of the box. And so it's true. We believe that we need to get our future leaders to commit simply 2 years and then to ask themselves, how can I personally have the greatest impact on this problem? And for some of them, you know, their answer is, I got to stay in teaching. And for others, it's to say, I got to go run a whole school or a whole school system. And for others, it's to say, you know what, I'm going to pursue my lifelong passion, which is medicine. I've dying to be a doctor, but I'm going to work on public health issues because I'm seeing how absolutely inextricably linked they are to the fact that we have the educational inequity that we have.
You do write about that, too, the fact that, as you said, it's not just one answer or solution, and that what seems to work the most is in schools or with the teachers who bring to bear all of the social services and mental health and health services so that the students, the whole student, can be educated and helped. And I wonder, how well do you see that happening? Is that beginning to scale up, or is that still just sort of little pockets around the country?
Well, I think You know, I think back to, I guess I've never met a Teach for America core member who was really successful with their kids, who thought that they were trying to give their kids what kids in privileged communities next door have. You know, that's not their mindset. They're thinking, I've got to give them a lot more, because they just face more challenges. And so if that means, you know, accessing additional social services for them or having breakfast in their room when they arrive at school or whatever it means, they're going to just do whatever it takes. And I think, you know, the very highly successful schools in urban and rural areas are doing the same thing. You know, this is a very activist approach to education. But I do think we're starting to see people embrace that approach because it's the only one that will possibly have the chance of leveling the playing field for kids.
Well, former President George W. Bush spoke of the soft bigotry of low expectations, and you addressed that. I mean, the belief of TFA is that all children can learn. And as you just said, sometimes you need the entire community has to come together to make that happen. What about the students who need even more than that? How do we reach them? Is there, and I'm thinking of a ride around I did a number of years ago in a local community with a truant officer, and he would pick up students who should have been in school and first go to their house. If their parent was home, say, hey, did you know that, you know, Johnny or Susie is wandering the streets? And then they take them to school. We went to several homes where there was a parent there, clearly not in any condition to do anything. And at one point, we got back into the car, and the officer said to me, that child doesn't stand a chance. And it was very, you know, disturbing, but there seemed to be a kind of a ring of truth to it. How do you, when you're dealing with such devastating issues in some kids' lives, how do you compensate? How can school compensate for that and pull them out of it?
I mean, I know for a fact that there are Teach for America alums in this audience right now who are just dying to answer that question. Because we believe parents are critical and influencers are critical. It's just that, you know, it's not an insurmountable thing. And, you know, if that's the challenge your kids face, then you got to figure out, you know, how do you help the kid around that challenge? But I've just heard person after person after person, you know, essentially, I mean, first of all, many of the kids we're working with have incredibly, you know, supportive parents. It's just that, you know, that doesn't need to be the impediment. And ultimately, if you take on what you can take on, like one thing we can do is give kids a good education so that they have the tools to have choices in life. And in fact, in a case like that, we have all the more responsibility to ensure that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Someone here wants to know about, given TFA's specific, rigorous, and effective training and support model, are there plans to expand this model beyond the core and into traditional credential or education programs? And I just heard about one at Hunter College. I thought maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
We are working in partnership with KIPP and Achievement First and Uncommon Schools, three charter networks, and Hunter College to create a new kind of school of education, I guess, as they're saying at Hunter College. I think one thing we're working on right now, we have learned a lot over time about what the most successful teachers in this context do, and it's that knowledge base that's informing our efforts to train and support our teachers, and we're working to publish a textbook that will link to an online set of resources that any new teacher, school district, teacher prep organization could access.
Now, you mentioned that the program at Hunter, which I think is called Teacher U or something like that, involves a lot of the charter schools because they also have the ability to kind of think out of the box. Have the traditional schools of education been receptive to kind of recreating their curriculum around similar types of models that you have?
I mean, I'll tell you where we've seen tremendous progress over time. Much more progress needing to happen, but tremendous progress is at the school district level. I mean, I think ultimately our reflection would be that we will never get where we're trying to go, which is, you know, a first-class education system, until our school districts invest what any well-functioning organization would invest in recruiting and developing talent. And yet, anyone who's been near our school systems knows, I mean, if you think about, you know, GE is known for its investment in talent development. Compare what they do to what any given school district does, and it's painful, but it's a lot less painful today than it was 10 years ago. I remember speaking at a conference, you know, 10 years ago, and basically putting out there the idea that our school system should recruit aggressively, and they should recruit from schools of education aggressively, because, you know, 40% of our ed school graduates never go into teaching. They should recruit as far beyond that as they need to find enough people who have the characteristics that they're looking for. And a very prominent education leader who I respect raised his hand, and he was so annoyed. And he's like, why should we have to recruit? He's like, accounting firms don't have to recruit. Literally, direct quote. And I just think we've come a long ways, because now we have school systems aggressively recruiting. So things are moving in our school systems, but they need to move more. And I think there's a role for schools of ed, but whatever that role is, it is not going to substitute for the fact that we need a whole different level of capacity at our districts, at the district level, to recruit, select, train, support, develop talent over time.
There are a number of more other questions, but let me just remind everyone that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Teach for America founder Wendy Kopp. I'm Catherine Barron. Someone wrote, change is harder in some places. For example, TFA pulled out of Detroit. Can you discuss the issues? Nor does it have a new teacher project. How can places like Detroit change?
Detroit had a unique set of circumstances, I think, in that it's a system where the student enrollment is declining rapidly. And in fact, teaching jobs are some of the most in-demand jobs, so it was just not a very popular idea for Teach for America to come in. And in fact, the district wasn't doing any hiring, so there was really, we could not find the path to maintaining a presence over time in Detroit. Although, you know, even there, thanks to a determined governor, I don't know the latest in Detroit, but I know that Governor Granholm is on a mission to get Teach for America and a number of other interventions back into Detroit. So you never know. I've found that time takes care of a lot of things. I mean, seriously, I mean, time. We've got to, if we stay the course, I mean, again, I think about where we are today versus even 5 years ago, and it's just such a different world. You know, I don't think we could have predicted where we would be today versus where we were then. So I think we got to just hang in there.
By we, you mean Teach for America or the...
And the broader, I mean, I think we have to keep going at this issue of education reform, even in places where it seems not possible. Go back to 3 years ago. I mean, I was attempting, because we've been placing teachers in Washington, D.C. since 1991, to help our local executive director raise funds in D.C., and we really couldn't find a place that was harder in the country to raise funds in than Washington, D.C., and the reason was that the civic leaders in that community had said, no, we're done. We have invested so much in these schools, and nothing has changed, and nothing will, and nothing you will say will convince us of that. If you had asked the national philanthropic community to list the cities where they had least sense of possibility there would ever be any progress, I guarantee you on the top five would be Washington, D.C. Another on the top five would have been New Orleans. And you just think about, wow, now all we're talking about is New Orleans and Washington, D.C., and that is what's leading us to say, we got to get ready. Like, there are so many communities across the country where there is serious momentum where 5 years ago we would never have predicted it. So we better get ready, because this snowball is rolling down the hill faster and faster, and we won't have enough talent and leadership to take advantage of it when it comes.
Do you see TFA getting involved in preschool? A lot of the research that's been coming out over the past few decades has really talked about the massive impact of good, high-quality pre-K education. You know, from 1 to 5, how quickly the brain develops, and that we really need to get children at that point.
Yeah.
Has that been
something? We started in recent years, about 3 years ago, we placed our first cohort of teachers at the pre-K level, and we're seeing incredible, incredible results. I mean, literally stopping the achievement gap before it starts. There's a school in Houston that was started by a guy named Aaron Brenner that takes 3- and 4-year-olds and literally has them by kindergarten reading on average. I mean, this is serving kids in, you know, one of the highest poverty communities in Houston. And his kids, by the time they're in kindergarten, are on average reading at the second grade level. This is part of the KIPP network in Houston, and the kids who are coming into the fifth grade in the KIPP school are reading on average the second grade level. That is incredible. I mean, if you need any evidence of we need to invest in this issue and we can solve it, it's right there.
So how have things been with the teachers' unions in recent years?
Our teachers, they're coming in, they're being hired by school systems into vacant positions, and they become union members. So, we work closely with the unions locally and even nationally.
I can't let you get off that easily.
It's true.
One of the criticisms is from some members of the union and from other people I know who work in education organizations in D.C. is that it lets the schools off the hook, that if they can bring in a Teach for America teacher, particularly, say, in some of the very hard-to-staff areas, such as special education or high school math and science, that it lets them off the hook for doing recruitment to get a long-term person, high-quality person in that spot. And that's their concern, that they don't have to work so hard if you come in and fill that void.
I'm thinking that we need to rethink many paradigms that have, seemingly governed the day. And I think one of the paradigms people work off of is this idea. I mean, you still hear it all over the place. People have this idea that there's the medical profession and therefore there's a teaching profession and we need to train our doctors and our teachers the same way. You think about it for 10 seconds and you realize, wait, this is an analogy that may not make sense. You know, if you're the wealthiest person in America, it's true, you're going to want a very highly trained doctor, right? If you're the wealthiest person in America, you're fighting to get your kids into schools where the teaching faculty looks exactly like Teach for America, core members and alums. So, and I think what our experience has been is you get into the heart of it and realize what is the essence of teaching truly, and it would inform a whole different approach to recruiting and selecting and training and supporting teachers over time. So I just think, I guess over time I've come to think that, if I was a school system superintendent, I would go out and recruit, as I said before, really aggressively to get enough people with the personal characteristics I know it takes to succeed with kids, and then I would start investing in trying to keep them. And we know it's possible to keep them, and it's possible to keep the Teach for America folks, which a lot of principals and school systems are doing.
Someone asks, how can your recruiting efforts attract teachers who have lived a life of poverty when your main pool of teachers are surrounded by so many resources, such as of an Ivy League college, and they have such high GPAs? So I know you talk about diversity in terms of race, gender, and ethnicity, but what about their their socioeconomic status growing up?
We actually also make a real effort to recruit folks from low-income backgrounds. And, in fact, I think the message of Teach for America resonates hugely with those folks. In fact, we have data to prove it. When we can get in front of people who grew up in the communities where we're working, they're much more likely to join. So we do a lot and, in fact, are very disproportionately diverse. I mean, I think one of the problems Teach for America faces is that we're fighting the very problem we're working to address when we go recruit on campuses. Our campuses are so non-diverse. We recruit at 400 campuses. 5% of the graduating seniors are African American, and 5% are Latino Hispanic, and some tiny fraction actually grew up in low-income communities. And that is a tragedy, but we know that to be successful, we have to be a lot more diverse than those 400 campuses are, and that's why we put so much energy into seeking folks out from those backgrounds and convincing them in particular to apply. About 26% of our core last year had Pell Grants as one indication of their socioeconomic background, and that compares to about 16% of students at those 400 schools who had Pell Grants.
If you could do, say, three things today to change public education in this country, what would they be? It's kind of one of those, if you had your druthers, you know, and all the money and resources.
Well, you're going to think I'm very single-minded, but one thing I would do is invest in getting the 1,000 people off the wait list. Seriously, I would invest we have an incredible opportunity right now, and in part I think it's the silver lining of this economic environment. In part it's the mood of the country. But, you know, I think our most highly sought after graduates almost feel a license to think differently about their futures. And if, you know, we have the chance to jump into that window and channel their talent and energy against the problem that, you know, we have to agree is the key to our long-term economic strength, not to mention to the well-being and welfare and everything else of kids and families and communities. So that is truly, I mean, I think if I reflect on the last two decades in this work, talent and leadership, you know, it's the fundamental driver of progress and change. So that is the one thing I would do. Another thing I would do is I would embrace the idea of getting all of our states aligned to internationally benchmarked standards, and then I would invest hugely in really high-quality assessments and measures. I mean, we're just living in the dark ages, and any good teacher knows, I mean, you have to have good data to understand where your kids are and to assess their progress over time. And, you know, we should be able to have every parent and kid and teacher and principal and school superintendent right now go look at a database and see where is this kid against standards. We can't do it. I mean, this is, you know, so that's and that is actually something that this administration is investing significantly in, and I think that's really encouraging. So those are two things I would do. I think, you know, I'm sounding like Arne Duncan here because I hear him say all the same stuff, but he's saying standards, human capital, and scale what works. You know, I think, again, I mean, it is, last week I was in Philadelphia, and I was recalling for a group of our supporters there that 6 years previous to that, to now, when we had just started in Philadelphia, we literally were giving our core members train tickets to go to New York to see evidence that it was possible for urban kids to excel academically, literally. Our program team said they could find no evidence of it in Philadelphia. There was no school that was proving what could be done. They couldn't find the teachers. So we finally said, look, then give them train tickets. We know it's happening in New York. And it's just crazy to think about that, because today in Philadelphia, we're not given any train tickets. There are actually, you know, not only I keep saying KIPP, but there are high-performing schools, Mastery Charter Schools, KIPP Charter Schools, that are proving what's possible. And I think more and more and more that we can prove what's possible, that's going to help tip the scales as well.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one more question. And somebody's written one in that sort of talks about the past and takes us into the future. So you've been in an interesting position with Teach for America. You were there before No Child Left Behind and through it, and now you'll be there as it is reauthorized. What have you seen that worked? What didn't work? And how would you like to see it changed?
Well, I mean, I think that, No Child Left Behind, in so many ways at the outset of that, represented people coming together across the political aisle to commit ourselves as a country for the first time to measurable progress in closing the achievement gap. So, I mean, to me, the fundamental premise of No Child Left Behind is, you know, it's what this whole effort is all about. I think what we, I guess my big takeaway from reflecting on sort of what didn't go well, you just saw from that the limits of a federal mandate, you know. And, you know, in a world where you had, you know, people complain about No Child Left Behind and they talk about the schools where principals pulled their kids out of classes and stuck them in cafeterias for 2 months and just gave them test prep books. Or they complain about the states that have lowered their standards, some 30-something of them, in order to be able to meet the requirements of the federal mandate. And I just think, now really, was that really the federal government's fault? Like, what's going on there? What's going on there is a lack of commitment at the local level, plain and simple. And so I guess I just, you know, it's led me to wonder, you know, I think we need, you know, we need the standards, we need the central investments, but you know what, there's just no substitute. There is no substitute for local leadership and commitment. And somehow we got to figure out how to inspire more of that. And I don't think that micromanaging, we're not going to get there through micromanaging the system. We're going to get there through somehow other strategies. So I would take all that into account in the reauthorization. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks to Wendy Kopp, CEO and founder of Teach for America and author of One Day All Children. I think there are some copies out there also. We also thank all of you here and those listening on the radio. This program has been generously sponsored by Visa. I'm Catherine Barron, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.